Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, live from Los Angeles, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. I'm actually out here behind the woodshed. I'm hanging out with Joel Embiid. Carl Towns had something to say about that last night.
Yeah, that was... There were a couple plays down the stretch where you could tell Towns was like really going at him.
That was a humbling experience for Joel Embiid. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about Embiid, rightfully so, opening month of the season. He's put up some unbelievable stat lines. More power to him playing through the minutes limit. But when you just sort of look at like where their games are technically, like at this moment in time, that was a very one-sided one-on-one matchup last night.
Yeah, you could tell Cat was motivated, and it was cool to see. And I mean, Embiid is great too. Like per 36, he is Wilt Chamberlain / Hakeem Olajuwon. Like I get it, but it was fun to see Cat sort of go after him a little bit.
Yeah, and I hate the per 36 thing because you got to play 36, so that bothers me like right off the top when it comes to him, but. He has shown a lot in this first month, and I actually thought he was kind of up for that test too, and that was part of the reason why he looked so, kind of defeated there by the end of it, was because, you know, he realized this was sort of a measuring stick game, right? Like, these are two guys who could easily be in the discussion as the best NBA big man. You know, we did that feature on SI together, the 20 predictions for 2020, and one of the questions I had to answer was, who's going to be the best big 4 years from now? I went with Towns. And even though I've had these questions about Embiid, you know, basically the last 2 years, like I had to give him a look, right? Like you have to put him in the mix for that. So I thought both guys sort of entered that game, with something to prove. And I mean, Towns, the up fake, the blow by, and then the absolute posterization on Luwawu. And then a few of the moves in the post where he's just hitting Embiid with like three or four counters over either shoulder.
Oh yeah.
I mean, give me a break. It's beautiful.
Yeah, he turned the fourth quarter into like an and-one mixtape for big men. It was pretty impressive. And I'm on the same page as you with Towns. If I had to pick among the big men because of Anthony Davis's health and Joel Embiid's health, I would definitely take Towns for the future. And Porzingis is in the mix too. But it was definitely a little weird where there were a couple weeks there where everybody was like, well, Embiid's like definitely number one, and then it's like or Embiid is on the same level as Anthony Davis and Towns, like it's a debate. Like I want to see Embiid actually stay healthy for a couple months here and start to play like 30 minutes a game before we start putting him in those conversations.
Oh,
but
for
listen,
sure.
most importantly, I'm really impressed that you came away with some like legitimate takeaways after last night's putrid night of basketball.
Oh yeah. I mean, it actually got so bad during the third quarter of the Bulls versus Jazz game when both teams were just like flinging the basketball at the rim without any real intention of trying to get it to go through that. I actually did the Time Inc. internet security training video during the third quarter of that game.
Nice.
So I'm ready to go. Like, don't even try to fish me. Like I'm
way
ready.
Way to be a good employee. Shout out to you.
That's how low it fell last night. Yeah, but one real quick thing on Towns though. Like people know I'm not a real big isolation guy. Like don't pound the ball into bigs and ask them to do work for extended stretches. It's just not really the way that it works in the NBA anymore. But if you've got Wiggins shooting the ball so well, spacing the court around him, you've got Towns who can move seamlessly from the perimeter back into the post, and he can make really good decisions in a quick manner. It doesn't really bog things down for him to, make a hard cut to the block, take an entry pass, and then do something smart with it. And sometimes doing something smart with it is just kicking the ball back out and keeping the ball moving. Sometimes doing something smart with it is unleashing four moves, left to right, back to back, dream shake, and getting a wide open layup out of it. So I think, there's a big difference between using someone like Towns in post situations and then turning over a chunk of your offense to say like Greg Monroe or Enes Kanter or one of these other guys who's really going to kind of, change the look. So for me, it's like the best of both worlds with Towns. And man, it was an impressive performance last night.
Well, yeah, Towns, it's the passing, his ability to kick and find guys who are open is what is pretty crazy for a guy who is still, I think he's only 20 years old at this point. And that is, that's the piece that makes him so scary for the future. And we'll get to Wiggins. We got some mailbag questions today, but I will say I actually bet on the Jazz Bulls game. So I was invested, and I was so upset at myself for making myself watch that game. Basically, there was a point in the third quarter where I wasn't sure either team was going to break 80.
Yeah, that was not the greatest night of TNT basketball that we've ever seen. And actually, a bunch of the other, like the alternate league pass games, were pretty rough too. Like Houston just smacked Portland. You know, they left Portland kind of whining in the locker room about how terrible they are afterwards. I mean, James Harden, it really looked like he was playing like 1-on-0. I mean, he was just moving so smoothly. It was like he was doing lap swimming through Portland's defense, like whenever he wanted. I mean, it was pretty pathetic. And
the Blazers might have some defensive issues. Just for some background real quick, so coming into this year, we have new podcast producers from DG, and we met with them, and they were like, you know, the podcasts will really do best if you release them at 3 a.m. And so that would mean us recording every afternoon and then releasing the following day. And at the time, I was like, the Thunder and Warriors were on a Thursday night. And I was like, guys, like, we can't record Thursday afternoons because Thursday nights are like the biggest night in basketball. We're going to end up being sort of behind the curve like every Friday. And credit to you, you had my back. But then we got off the call and you were like, you know, most Thursdays around the NBA are going to be pretty bleak and it's not going to make a difference. And it turns out once you get past those marquee games, you are correct.
Well, personally, I'm really glad that we waited till today because, you know, a lot of people wanted to hear our thoughts about Utah's offensive breakdowns there in the second half. And if we hadn't waited until today, they wouldn't have had these takes, and then everything we would have talked about yesterday would be stale. So thank God for us.
Exactly. But listen, we are not here to talk about last night's wretched basketball. We are here to talk. We got mailbag questions today.
I'm pumped about this.
Are you excited?
Oh, yeah. I'm pumped about this. I got some great questions, actually. I know you got a lot of questions. You're probably going to have most of the questions, but I got some really good questions, too.
Yeah. Thank you to everyone who submitted. I was not sure what the quality of questions would be. A couple times we've gone on Facebook Live, and they've been pretty bleak, but you guys came through. We have a lot of good questions. We'll try to get to most of them today. You want to just jump right in?
Yeah, let's do these quick too. I mean, we don't need to spend 20 minutes on every question. I know I tend to talk too long. So let's move through these, knock them down, just like the pros that we are in our Mack Weldon sweatpants.
Perfect. First question from Aaron Barry. This is the first question we got. Is George Hill the most boring player to ever average 20 points per game? He's the 128th highest paid player in the league.
I love how we just transitioned from, oh, the Jazz is horrible offense, to a question about the Jazz's horrible offense.
Sticking with Utah.
Man, what a good, what a smooth transition. Well, first of all, I think you could say last night, I mean, they could have used a little George Hill in their life, couldn't they?
Where do you stand on the George Hill spectrum? I feel like he's either overrated by, like, hardcore basketball fans stand out really, really hard for George Hill. And like the George Hill hive is passionate. And then you got casual basketball fans who are like, who is George Hill? Why does anyone care about George Hill? The Pacers will obviously be better with Jeff Teague. That's not true either. So where are you?
I think I'm right on the fringe of the hive. I don't know if I'm a fully inducted member, but I'm pretty much there. Rob Mahoney is definitely a Hive member.
Definitely.
Rob Mahoney would give a few of his fingers for George Hill, like without really a second thought.
I am pretty surprised that George Hill didn't crack the top 25 on your guys' top 100 list.
The thing about George Hill, and I know he's had this, you know, big offensive numbers to start the season, like the person asked in the question, and a lot of that is just system and role and fit and who was out and how they're kind of trying to piece things together. But to me, it's just like defensively, he is built like exactly how you would want out of a, you know, like if you could just construct a player defensively for the point guard position, that's basically the guy you would construct. And so that's the main reason why I've always been higher than most on him. I think the fact that he's transitioned so well offensively in Utah was a surprise, but I think their bigger issue is just the consistency. They got to keep these guys on the court. If Favors is never going to be out there and they're playing Boris Diaw, like God bless his bloated soul, but you know, it's not going to matter how many points you get from a George Hill. And I don't think he can sustain this level of offense over the course of a season. You know, their attack's going to kind of struggle.
Yeah. You mentioned Diaw, and like I said, I bet on that game last night. And as soon as I tuned in and saw Boris Diaw starting, I regretted my decision to back the Jazz by 3 last night. Diaw is just not in a spot where you can really trust him to play major minutes. And Trey Lyles is actually really solid, and I think they'll be in good shape with him. But anyways, George Hill. My thing with him is that he is super useful and is exactly the kind of like modern guard that any team could use. But I don't think he's indispensable in any situation. And what's happened with him in Utah so far, I think is more a reflection of how badly they needed a point guard.
Yeah, for sure. He's a really good player, though. And I think that most people consider him boring, sort of like as the question set up. And yeah, like he's not going to be a highlight reel type guy either with the pass, with the drive, or with his shot very often. But he's the type of player who, if you can snag for a middling first round pick in a draft that, you know, may or may not produce a ton of talent in that range, and then you have the potential now to re-sign him long term. If you're the Jazz, like, yeah, you do that and you really don't think twice and you kind of run out of the liquor store as fast as possible and hope that nobody's following you, you know? I mean, that's a heist.
Yeah. They're going to have an interesting decision this summer when they have to decide how much to pay him and whether he's good enough to make him like a real part of their core going forward. But okay, to answer the question here, this question came in on a Tuesday and I went back and looked up some past 20 point scorers and
that's really not the highest bar, you know.
It's not as high as it would seem. And in 1992, Brad Doherty averaged 20 points a game for the Cavs. And personally, I think that Brad Doherty is a lot more boring than George Hill.
Well, I actually saw a picture of Brad Doherty, one of those old All-Star team pictures. He looked really excited to be like in the same presence as Michael Jordan. Like he just kind of had that glow about him. Like, oh wow, like they let me be in this photo. So yeah, I think he could totally go in that one. I mean, you could also
his game was just like strictly back to the basket. I don't know. He was very much like the missionary position of basketball, which is fine, but.
What about Brook Lopez? I think he's got to be in this mix.
Brook Lopez is definitely in the mix too. But Brad Doherty, I think now currently hosts a NASCAR show, and no shots at Brad Doherty. I don't know. It's not what I'm looking for. And Brook Lopez is now, I think he shot 10 threes the other night. So he's opening his game up a little bit.
Oh, he's now really exciting. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Move on. Moving on.
Wait, I found another one. What about Keith Van Horn?
Oh my God, Keith Van Horn's got to be in the mix. Remember, there were a couple years there where like the Larry Bird comparisons came early and often with him.
Yeah, I wasn't making those. But yeah, I'm just going through the Nets squad
was on the cover of Slam Magazine. Remember that?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I know that. Yeah. The socks just flying through the roof on those guys. I remember those pictures. All right, I've got another. I've got a question here, though. Okay, this one's from Montreal Marcos 123. Marcos wants to know, why do so many of my Raptors fellow fans constantly send you harassing messages on Twitter when we gave up 121 points to the Cavaliers and 127 points to the Warriors in less than 30 hours, and we arguably still don't have a quality win this entire season? Man, Marcos, that's a great question. Really, really good question.
Did you make up Marcos?
No, that seemed like a real question.
All right, sure. Good for you.
No, don't you think Marcos has a point, though?
Look, the Raptors are not on the Warriors and Cavs level, but they are really good. If I were them and the Raptors fans, you know, harassing you guys is one of their only like claims to fame right now.
Okay, so we can agree that the Raptors as a team are not on the Warriors and Cavaliers level. I guess the point, though, is the Raptors fan base now entering Cavs Twitter, Warriors Twitter echelon? I think it might be.
Yeah, the Raptors, I've been harassed by Raptors fans in the past. They have always been like this, and they have a legitimate claim to being disrespected because they're a really good team. And DeMar DeRozan is really good.
Do you think they're a really good team, though, or did they get a little bit of too much hype coming out of the gate because they had such a weak schedule? Because if you look at who they played, and by the way, I did a whole bunch of radio in Toronto this week, and all they wanted to do was whine about the back-to-back with the Cavaliers and Warriors as if that was like the greatest crime against humanity, you know? But their opening schedule, their wins, Detroit, Denver, Washington, Miami, Oklahoma City on the road, Charlotte, New York. So you got a couple nice wins there, Hornets and Thunder. But for the most part, kind of padded. You know, they lost to the Kings. We talked about that loss. It was terrible. And then they're 0-3 against the Cavs and Warriors in games that were fairly close, but I thought, you know, were pretty much kind of controlled by the other team. I think they're good. They seem awfully reliant on DeRozan, maybe to the point of over-reliance. Damari Carroll kind of being nothing so far this season is a big-time question mark for me. And then they got to be happy with their young bigs kind of stepping up and filling minutes. But also at the same time, you got to wonder, are they going to be able to kind of hold that fort down over the course of a season? I think they've got some questions. I think they're good. I mean, are you ready to say they're the second best team in the East, though?
I'm not. But are you happy? I gave you the ISO to do your Raptors spiel. And yes, I think the second best team in the East is probably going to be the Hawks. I think the Celtics, once they get healthy, will be in the mix, and the Raptors are going to be either 3 or 4, which is, you know, that's kind of what they were last year. Like, that's fine. I root for the Wizards, a team that, like, more often than not, I tune in and like question my life decisions and the last like several years of my life. So, I like Raptors fans should be happy. And continue harassing you because, you know, you don't give them enough respect.
But I don't know. I mean,
I can't believe we have all these different, we have all these different mailbag questions and you made up a question to talk about the Raptors. I love it.
Well, I love it. Hang tight. There could be more. Let's go. Next question.
Okay. So, Mikey $5 he offered a follow-up question to our previous podcast earlier this week. How is Melo a stranded superstar when he demanded to go to a team that was shit in the first place? And that's a fair point, Mikey $5.
Didn't I say that on the podcast, though? Like, we kind of had to treat him a little bit differently just because he had agency in that decision, similar to, like, Westbrook and Harden. But he is still stranded. He just kind of like, he basically went out to the island on a rowboat, got to the island, and then sank the rowboat, if that makes sense. And then he's like, oh crap, now I'm stuck.
Exactly. And I want to make one point about the stranded superstars thing. And you made the point in your article, but like, these guys aren't blameless. John Wall isn't blameless for the way things have gone in DC. DeMarcus Cousins, same deal. Melo, similar. Although one thing I think people don't give him enough credit for is that, like, had he gone to LA to play with Kobe, it would have been a disaster. Had he gone to Chicago to play with like a broken down Derrick Rose and a broken down Bulls roster, it probably would not have gone nearly as well as we thought it would have at the time. And at the same time, he was like, it was a $30 million difference that he was dealing with. It was a serious, serious amount of money. It wasn't like D-Wade, I'll take $4 million less to play with LeBron James.
Yeah, what's weird is that he kind of gets thrown into this the mogul conversation, you know? These guys who are like really have a lot going on, off the court, yeah. Big business interests and so forth. And you kind of do the contrast of like, well, LeBron, Wade, Bosch, and Pat Riley orchestrated like 19 steps that were necessary to put them together, and then they won two titles because of it. And then you look at Melo's like last 5 or 6 years, like where was the mogul planning in terms of like constructing any sort of a roster around him or finding a free agency destination like you're mentioning that would really make sense? Like it seems like he was sort of a bystander to his own life, you know, like there wasn't ever really the like a credible situation that seemed like it would be a really good fit for him. You know, it's like really cool mogul work. You're stuck in New York. And the only reason why the situation isn't like the most depressing in the entire NBA is because they hit a freaking home run with Porzingis, which, you know, it's still inexplicable to me how that happened given Phil Jackson's other track record, because he's just made like the worst trades, the worst free agency signings, and he hit one home run. Besides that home run, Melo would be in arguably like the worst position in the entire league, right?
I cannot believe you just called Carmelo Anthony a bystander in his own life. that might be meaner than any DeRozan criticism you've had. Yeah, I don't know. I like, look, with those stranded superstars, my biggest thing is that it just as a basketball fan, it would be fun to see them paired up together or in a better situation. Like, it's not about like, obviously a lot of those guys own some of what's happened in their career.
And the bigger point you made too, and this applies to Melo, is it in the NBA's best interest to have one of their 10 to 15 exactly. most marketable stars stuck with, you know,
yeah, the whole league more interesting.
Yeah. I like Melo right now literally is dreaming of making the first round so he can lose in 5 games, right? That's like the dream. That's not a very healthy place for the league. And unfortunately, like there's not an easy solution to it either. And this is just sort of the byproduct, you know?
So, all right. Sticking with a couple more follow-ups to that pod. Mason Daly asks, which stranded star is the best fit for a Celtics trade? Real quick, Paul George.
He's the answer to every stranded superstar question because he's the best player of the group.
Yeah, but I also just feel like they have big men options. They don't need Boogie. They don't. I would not expect them to want John Wall. And you know, I guess Melo could also be in the mix, but
I think Paul George is the
one guy that they would give up real assets for.
And I still think this is a team when they're fully healthy, Crowder, Horford. I mean, that's a team that should be in elite defense. And if you put Paul George back into that mix, and instead of him trying to carry some of these young pieces in Indiana who are kind of trying to figure it out or, you know, trying to get over the Jeff Teague hump, you know, at the point guard position defensively, I think you could throw Paul George into that mix and they could be really, really, really good. And he'd have enough help where, like, if you have a playoff series against Cleveland, like maybe there's a fighting chance there in a best case scenario.
That's the Nets pick trade that I think is pretty realistic.
But that's hilarious.
The continue to struggle.
That's hilarious that the Celtics fans are the one who immediately write in to start poaching all these players. Surprise, surprise.
It's not just then. We also have, can you see a scenario where the Blazers are a landing spot for one of these stars? PG or Melo? I really cannot because of the Evan Turner deal. I mean, they'd have to give up McCollum, don't you think?
Well, what's really interesting about the Blazers right now is they're like dead last in defense, dead last in rebounding, and just getting killed night to night inside. So I've really started to see the Cousins talking yourself into him, rationalizing the Cousins move. Oh, he could be buddies with Lillard. Lillard could be the face of the team. I've really started to see that percolate on Blazers Twitter here the last like 10 days or so. So I actually think, you know, going big might be what they would prefer in their dream scenario than trying to add one of these wings, because Lillard is super high usage. And so even if you trade away CJ McCollum, which I would not be in a rush to do if I was Portland, I think Portland's best case scenario is like you slap together a whole bunch of these younger prospects and just kind of hope that you can create enough of a package with also with future picks where you can kind of talk somebody into, you know, taking on the flexibility and the youth that you've accumulated. I'm not sure if that would actually work, but that would be my goal. I wouldn't be rushing to break up the Lillard-McCollum duo.
Yeah, definitely not. Related, though, another question from Desi O'Grady. Wes Matthews for Evan Turner. Who says no? The Wes Matthews homecoming. Come on, man. No,
oh, Portland would be all about that. That's hilarious that they're already talking about that. Evan Turner, by the way, Evan Turner is dead last in the league in plus minus right now. It gets worse every night. Minus 18 again last night. Oof. And, you know, sorry, Jared Sullinger. I know you thought I rushed to judgment on that one.
Don't you think Evan Turner would be a solid fit in Dallas?
I don't know exactly if those words should be used together in the same sentence, like solid fit and Evan Turner. Not trying to be rude again. I just think it's really kind of hard to see him. And Dallas plays, I mean, they want to play kind of like Portland style, right? Terry Stotts, former Mavs assistant, they're trying to move the ball. They're trying to keep it going. Do you want Evan Turner just pounding, 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 and then he's going to swing it to Harrison Barnes late in the clock for a contested three? I don't know if I would say that that's a solid fit. I can't say the Blazers would welcome back, their fan base would welcome back Matthews with open arms, throw him a parade, and they would be like, they would probably break Twitter if that trade happened. Like, it would just shatter epicenter in Portland.
Yeah. At the time, it actually says a lot about how respected the Blazers have become, because their offseason made absolutely no sense. And everyone was like, huh, like maybe it'll work. Maybe Evan Turner is the ball handler that'll allow those guys to play off the ball, and this can make sense. And so far, I think conventional wisdom wins this round.
Well, yeah, the other thing I would say, though, is that their backup plan was always, if it didn't work, we're just going to auction some of these guys off, right? Like, we're just going to have like a swap meet sale where you can come and buy Alan Crabb at 80 cents on the dollar. You can trade for Evan Turner at a bargain basement price, or, you know, come test out Myers Leonard, you know, whatever it might be. Like, I think that was sort of the end game. And we haven't had enough time to have that play out. I mean, that's probably not going to happen until February at the earliest. So at some point, I would expect them. That's one of those teams where you can just like circle in red ink as a trade deadline team. Like, there's going to be something involved with those guys.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Next question.
Oh, wait, no, I got another one. I have another one over here.
Okay.
Yeah. It's from Toronto Tommy 6969. And he says, okay, I've been reading all the hype about DeMar DeRozan as the master of the mid-range. But when I watched him play against Cleveland both times, he failed to shoot a high percentage and he really struggled to get open looks. Is this guy really the next Michael Jordan, or are Toronto Raptors fans overreacting? Ooh, Tommy, another really good question, Tommy.
We're about to talk about DeRozan, because the next real question, apologies to Tommy, is who would your most improved starting five be for the year thus far? I sent you this in advance. Give me your list.
Well, I actually, all jokes aside, Raptors fans, I did consider DeMar DeRozan for this list, but ultimately I didn't put him on. I didn't know if he was really.
God.
I didn't know if he was really in the spirit of this list, though, because he's already an established star, right? I kind of went more for younger guys who hadn't made the All-Star team yet, if that's okay. But I understand why he would be on there. And actually, why don't you start with the DeRozan case for being on here?
DeRozan has gotten so much better in the same way that, like, from 2014 to last year, Steph got so much better, and you have to recognize that. What I liked this week is Durant was talking about him and said he's probably got the best footwork I've seen in a long time, and I couldn't put my finger on what about his game was so impressive, but the way he moves around the mid-range is just, he's in command at all times, and he hits a lot of tough shots, and at some point it can't be a fluke, okay? Maybe he's not going to average 35 all year, but he's going to average 30. And I don't know. I just think he is really, really good. Hold on. Can I also, I pulled a quote from DeRozan. I didn't get to enjoy the summer outside of being on the Olympic team and winning a gold medal. That was awesome. But socially, it was really one of them summers where it was just a sickening dedication to where I had a lot of days where it was just shit. It was really tough to be that self-motivated. It was sickening. And now it's paying off.
Yeah, okay. So here's going to be my real DeRozan take. I'm not going to tweak with the Raptors fans anymore. He has improved in a lot of areas. The footwork for sure is noticeable. I would say also his recognition of handling extra attention. In other words, finding the open man quickly and putting the ball on the mark so they can catch and shoot or they can catch and attack has definitely improved. His fluidity in the half court in terms of getting to his spots and not it's just
footwork,
kind of, not pounding, but also just sort of like the approach too, right? Like not bogging down, over dribbling, just kind of being decisive. I think that's really improved. Part of the issue though, still with me, and yes, he's hitting tons and tons of shots and he's better at hitting those shots than just about everybody, is that against good defenses, even this season, that hasn't really been the case, right? Like his main source of points against really good defenses still is getting to the free throw line. That's dried up for him in the past in the postseason, so I still think that's going to be an issue. And when you really concentrate your defense against him, as we saw, actually, I thought with both Cleveland and then to a lesser degree Golden State, because Golden State seemed more interested in just kind of blowing them out offensively on Drake night.
May not have to concentrate on defense all year.
Yeah, and they seem to have realized that, which might not be great for them. But I thought that, you know, he talked about how the game has slowed down for me, how he feels like Neo in the Matrix. And you can see that when he's playing against the Nuggets, right? It didn't really seem like that against the Cavaliers. Like, yes, he's still a dependable offensive weapon, but, you know, hands in his face, defenders who know what they're doing, help defenders who aren't completely out of position, I thought really, you know, pulled him back to earth pretty strong there. And so when I'm looking at this most improved conversation, it's like, yes, he's definitely a better version of himself, but I think he's playing over his head at this point. I think even most Raptors fans would agree. Like they're kind of hanging on for the ride here because, you know, these 35-point nights aren't going to last given that he's playing like 37 minutes a night. And, you know, at some point fatigue's going to kick in, right? Where does he wind up settling when the shooting numbers come back to earth and once he starts playing consistently good defenses that are locked in? To me, that's still a question. That being said, there is no doubt he's playing the best basketball of his life. I mean, that is beyond a question. And so for that reason, that's why I considered him for the most improved list.
So he's on our most improved list. I don't care what you say. Can I also say that... So Rob Mahoney wrote a nice piece about him this week and just some of the early season developments, responding to SI's top 100 ranking, et cetera, et cetera. And I actually saw a Reddit thread about that, and it was full of pissed off Raptors fans, just like saying like SI needs to fold. That place is a joke. 46, like that was just clickbait. And somebody mentioned this podcast, and they were like, that podcast, it's just two guys talking about, it's the same two guys talking about basketball every episode. They don't even prepare. And I was like, you know, guilty as charged on that one. You guys got us.
Not too worried about it.
I don't blame Raptors fans for hating our pod. Anyways, give me your five then. Give me your five most improved.
That was a humbling 48 hours for them though, don't you think? I mean... That was a tough back-to-back. All right. My five improved. Kemba Walker. You know, he's another guy who made a big jump last year. Never quite got into the All-Star conversation. And he is off to an even better start this year. And I think if you're a Hornets fan, you're like, why are you guys spending 20 minutes making fun of the Raptors? You should be talking about the Hornets because they're the real second-best team in the East.
Yeah. No, the Hornets are really good. I don't think that they're gonna top out at the second best team in the East, but I think they're due for a regression more than anyone else that's in that mix for the two seed. But we were talking before the season, and we were both kind of down on them because we were saying like I had thought that they had maxed out last year at when they won, I think 47 or 48, and were a six seed, and I just didn't see how they were going to get better this year. Because they lost Jeremy Lin, they lost Al Jefferson, they didn't really add anybody. Turns out Kemba has a whole other gear, and he's just been ridiculous thus far.
Yeah, and I was not necessarily anticipating that. And I think it's DeRozan-esque in terms of like the mid-career jump, you know, and so
yeah.
Great. Like let's watch that play out. They're also a team that kind of teases you though over the course of a season. You know what I mean? Like they'll put together some really strong 10 game stretches, and then there'll be a couple where it just kind of head scratchers. So I'm still with you. I'm not ready to kind of pencil them in right there at the top. But you know, they do seem to have separated from that pretty crowded middle class in the East. And
yeah.
So if they can keep doing that, this could be the year that they finally win a playoff series. You know, I could see that happening for them for sure. That would be a pretty natural next step in sort of their evolution. So,
people forget because D Wade came through at the end of that series, but Kemba in the playoffs last year was so good. And that was the biggest reason I was bummed about the Heat winning, is that some of the Kemba performances were sort of lost to history because of that. But he was awesome for them in May, or I guess it was April.
Yeah, for sure. It was April. Sorry, Hornets fans. All right. A couple others real quick, though. Wiggins, I think, has got to be in this mix. I mean, the three-point shooting and the comfort factor. You know, there's some DeRozan stuff kind of going on with him in terms of improved confidence and decision making with the ball in his hands. Needs to improve, I think, as a passer. But you know, dating back to when I first saw him, I think like his sophomore, junior year in high school, the guy always seemed like he had the tools to be a 3-point shooter, and it was just like endlessly frustrating for 2 years watching Sam Mitchell just not figure out how to do that. And like lo and behold, Tom Thibodeau shows up, and boom! Now all of a sudden, Wiggins is this 3-point threat. So I think that. That kind of thing is the difference between him being like a potential superstar and then him being a plus wing. You know what I mean? Like if you never really figure out how to do that, there's a big swing there.
Well, and think about it this way. I think a lot of people had compared him to DeMar DeRozan last year. And if he is a version of DeMar DeRozan that is also shooting 40 or low 40s from three and is hitting a couple each game, like that is a really, really dangerous player. And quick stat for you, usually you are the guy with the stats, but over the last six games, Wiggins is averaging 33 points on 50% shooting, 53% from three, and 5 rebounds and 4 assists. Like that is the player that I think people expected him to be when he was the number one pick, but I think over the last few years with Sam Mitchell, people started to give up on him a little bit ever hitting that point.
Yeah, and again, just remember, I mean, 21-year-old, 22-year-old Andrew Wiggins is kind of being comped to some of the better, you know, 25, 26-year-old wings right now. So like zoom back and like, what did DeMar look like when he was 21, right? Like there's no comparison to given where DeRozan was at that point of his career to where Wiggins is right now. So I think in terms of his ceiling and like what he can become, it may still take a couple of years, but like it's still off the charts. A couple other guys I had, I think we've talked about Julius Randle before. Probably don't need to run through him. You know, one guy actually for Toronto who surprised me, you know, Bebe Noguera, their long-armed Brazilian.
Oh, that's a good one, man.
Yeah, that's kind of a deep cut. And it's not like he's putting up insane numbers. Like I think it's pretty modest statistical output. But just the fact that he's playing like meaningful rotation minutes for a winning team was not necessarily something I ever expected. Again, I saw him first play back at the Hoop Summit years and years ago, and he's the kind of person who just like makes you fall over when you walk in the gym just with his, you know, physical measurements. But there always seemed like something was missing there. And it does seem like the light's gone on a little bit for him. Dwayne Casey's going to kind of have to construct the right role to kind of get the most out of him and limit the damage that he might do at certain points of various matchups and fouls and so forth. But I don't know. I think you got to put him in that mix because
that's
kind of
a really
breakout.
Solid. That's a solid deep cut. And I think he's sort of like a Biombo type guy for them. And that's all he needs to be for them. So he's in a good spot. And I have been rooting for him ever since draft night. He had one of the best afros I've ever seen at the draft, and his picture with David Stern from that night is probably one of my favorite draft moments ever. So I have always been pulling for Bebe Nogueira to put it together in the NBA.
Well, if it really comes to fruition, I mean, there's a situation where like he's in that closing games, fourth quarter lineup, in playoff games. And if that's where we're headed, that could make for some really, really fun times in the postseason.
All right. So who else do you have?
Well, actually, I was going to ask you on this one. What do you think of, is Otto Porter? I mean, are we going to give him the love there?
I don't think so. Not yet. He's got to put it together a little bit more consistently. But this is a good opportunity. We should segue to the Wizards. I'll finish out. My five were Kemba, DeRozan, Wiggins. Harrison Barnes got consideration as a stretch four in my starting five. Rudy Gay also got consideration, except that I feel like 10 years in, you're not really eligible for most improved. If you're most improved 10 years in, that means you were kind of slacking off at some point earlier. But I think Kevin Love has got to be in consideration, because he's been like putting up some ridiculous numbers for the Cavs. And he's another guy who, after the past few years, people just kind of assumed wasn't really good anymore. But 21-11 for them. He put up 27-16 against the Pacers, albeit without LeBron. I don't know. I think he has looked better than I thought he would.
Yeah, he's kind of like a chameleon, man. Like his career narrative changes like every month, you know, like, and part of that is just situation and taking that big step back, sort of like, you know, very Boschian. But yeah, it's easy to forget that 3 years ago he was, you know, an MVP type guy, putting up 20s and 15s every single night.
Yeah, and one of the reasons the Cavs look so good is because he looks more confident than he's ever been. Kyrie looks more confident than he's ever been, and they finally have that like super team feel, which for the better part of the last 2 years they didn't really click, but now they're clicking, and it's fun to watch. And then Julius Randle, we have a soft spot for Julius Randle, so he's the five. Embiid also got consideration, but. Continuing with the mailbag, we got several questions about the Wizards. So I will read these off and answer quickly. Does Ernie Grunfeld have naked photos of Ted Leonsis from Hoya Eagle? I think what's remarkable is that people have been making this joke for like at least 5 years now, and we're still here. So make of that what you will. Who was the worst signing of the offseason? Specifically, who was the worst player to get a player option? Jake Whittaker. That is a reference to Jason Smith from the Wizards. Did you know Jason Smith was still in the league?
Yeah, we talked about him on Monday's podcast, and we laughed at his contract and the offer.
Yes.
Hey, also, hey, do you remember that 1 hour over the summer where you were pretty excited about Trey Burke?
Yeah, look, man. It's been bleak.
Worst signing of the summer, I think, was Joakim Noah, though.
That's actually a good point. That's a really good point. Joakim Noah has been brutal. Marcus Thornton played 37 minutes in the Wizards' loss to the Sixers. When exactly do you expect the apocalypse to begin, Adam Rubin? So you saw the Wizards fan, the kid crying, right?
Oh, yeah.
That captures what the Marcus Thornton experience has been like for me this year.
So do you really refer to your firstborn son as the kid?
Yeah, I do. I do. He and I, no, I don't know. I just look, I can't form coherent thoughts right now because I'm thinking about Marcus Thornton playing 35 minutes a game for my favorite basketball team.
I think everyone agrees. We've talked enough about the Wizards. All right. What's the next?
No. We have two more. How many Wizards losses will it take for you to adopt the baby Lakers as your new favorite team? Book Warmington.
Already happened.
I am so there already that we're good. It goes baby Lakers, Wolves, Wizards for me right now. And then Dan Whiteman asks, since you guys love fake trades and stranded stars, how about Embiid for Wall? I'm rooting for Joel Embiid. And for that reason alone, I don't think you would ever want to send him to DC, because if you want to guarantee that he re-injures his feet, send him to the Wizards. So for that reason alone, I'm out on Embiid. I also don't want to root for another player on a minutes limit. And but related, the one thought that crossed my mind as the Wizards were getting blown out by the Sixers on, I think it was Wednesday night, Beal for Okafor and a pick would make a decent amount of sense for both sides.
That I would run into that if I was Philadelphia. I mean, that would be like the greatest moment of my life. For Washington, yeah. I would do that and then just fold the franchise. I mean,
not necessarily blow up the franchise, but I think
like fold as a franchise, like just leave the sport of professional basketball, it would not work.
I guess so. I just think if the season really breaks bad, you really can't get into a situation where you're like a crappier version of the Blazers and you're paying $300 million to Otto Porter, John Wall, and Bradley Beal. And if that's the case, find someone who would take Beal. Beal would fit really nicely next to Ben Simmons if he were healthy.
For sure. I don't see how Okafor helps him. Or really anybody.
Oh, he doesn't. It would be about a pick, and then you'd take on Okafor, and you'd also not have to pay $120 million to Bradley Beal over the next 5 years.
Wow. So just for the record, though, it took 11 games for the Bradley Beal contract to look terrible. Is that what we're, is that what we're agreeing on?
Yeah, I think so. And at the same time, like the door is still open. He could play really well and stay healthy for the next couple months, and they would be in much better shape. But I'm just saying, if you're looking around the league at options and places you could trade him, the Sixers are one of the only ones who it would actually make a decent amount of sense for. Can we go to my favorite question this week?
Yes. Thank God it's not about the Wizards.
It's not about the Wizards. You have to fight 5-on-5 to the death, no weapons, against 5 other NBA players. Which 4 players are you rolling with? This is from Gary Jones.
You go first.
Okay. And first of all, I chose to think about this as you versus me, and then we each pick 4 guys. And for those who don't know, you are like unreasonably tall, so you would probably have the advantage in one-on-one with
hold on. You chose to approach this question as a strategic way for killing me. That's how you took this?
No, I'm just saying, think of it like we both pick 4 guys as our teammates, and then we do battle. And I'm going to go so far as to just guarantee victory here, because
disrespect.
My 5, despite my disadvantages to you personally, because you're like 6'4", you don't eat meat, you drink 4 Red Bulls a day, I still feel pretty confident, because I'm going with Chris Paul, who is just straight up diabolical, Udonis Haslem, Yusuf Nurkic, if it were just me and Yusuf Nurkic, I would still feel pretty confident. And with Nurkic and Chris Paul on my side, we're not losing in any battle. And then the final spot, I took Tony Allen, not necessarily because he's the greatest fighter at this point in his career. I think 2011 Tony Allen would be unbeatable. 2016 Tony Allen, I think, he's a kinder, gentler. He's like Uncle Grit and Grind, but I would also just like to hang out with him. So he rounds out my 5.
Well, this is very telling how you approach this, because in your mind you were trying to kill me, which I'm going to take personally here probably for the next 2 weeks.
No, look, I'm trying to survive.
Okay,
it's not about killing anybody.
Here's how I approach this question, because this is a question I've gotten before from various Reddit people and so forth. You know, I'm not really in a violent mood right now after last week's, you know, election and so forth. So I spun this. I tried to pick the four guys who I would want to go with me to negotiate a peace treaty because I'm not really about war right now.
Oh,
I took Chris
out of here.
I took Chris Paul also. So we're going to have to fight over Chris Paul because I think ultimately he's the best negotiator in the league in terms of like getting what he wants.
So I took real quick on Chris Paul.
Yeah.
I had a friend the other day say, I really think LeBron James is going to go into politics after playing. And I was like, I don't know. You probably don't pay close enough attention to LeBron James in that case because he just like politics would be a bad fit for LeBron. You know who politics would be perfect for is Chris Paul because he's a great speaker. He has kind of an infectious personality, but then behind closed doors, he would be absolutely ruthless and is not afraid to get his hands dirty, knows where the bodies are buried. Chris Paul reminds me more of David Stern than probably anyone in the league.
He has the most important characteristic for a politician, which is that he has to squeeze the last drop out of every argument, conversation, or discussion. That is the single most important thing to be a politician. You know, you have to care about that last bridge or the last $15 for your infrastructure bill. And I think Chris Paul is really wired that way.
Well, and then he's also got like a winning smile. I mean, people like him. He's legitimately charming.
For sure. So he's the head of my peace coalition, my peace treaty negotiation coalition. Followed by him, I've got Mike Conley. Now, people, I think he is sort of the good cop in this scenario, you know, very friendly, very affable. He's going to be the one kind of moving around the United Nations room, shaking everyone's hands, kind of buttering people up, so to speak, before Chris Paul is sort of goes for the kill.
I cannot believe you made a peace treaty team. I'm so mad at you.
I'm sorry. Like, it's just, I'm not in the mood to like, first of all, I'm not trying to kill you like you're trying to kill me, which is a little scary. Well,
okay, only one of us is going to survive. That's what I'm taking away from this podcast.
We're negotiating our way out of death. I'm going to guarantee that. I've also got Harrison Barnes because he might actually be a senator right now. We're not sure. And then as my kind of looming presence in the negotiations, I have Kawhi Leonard. I think that a lot of times a look can get a deal done. You know, if you just kind of stare at someone, and there is hardly anyone in the NBA I would rather be negotiating with over almost anything because I would be fearing his look. You know what I mean? Like if he just kind of gives you that glance, it's like, okay, fine, you can have it, you know? So I think that's my team. Me, Chris Paul, Mike Conley, Kawhi Leonard, Harrison Barnes. I think we've got all the important negotiation bases covered and we're coming out ahead. And I think the world will be a better place. And you can just, you know, be happy about my dead body. Great.
That's great. Well, Yusuf Nurkic just body slammed Harrison Barnes to death. And, I am feeling great about my survival chances during the apocalypse of a Trump presidency. We are in good shape. I am standing with Yusuf and Udonis, and it's going to be fun. All right, let's do a couple more questions here before we have to go. Lindsey Schnell, a coworker at Sports Illustrated, great college football writer, said, I'd like a brief conversation on Myers-Leonard's man bun, please.
Well, I think it's kind of one of those situations where you mentioned how DeMar DeRozan had a tough summer. You know, like he had no fun. He was just in the gym working on his game, turning himself into a new player, taking the leap. I think at a certain point, you know, there's a wake up moment during training camp where you realize that maybe you didn't make that leap, right? And so you start looking for ways to kind of change the conversation. And I think one of the easiest ways to do that is facial hair, haircut, headband. And so I think what we're seeing is, you know, what, year five for Myers, gets the big contract, coming off an injury. Kind of the same player he was 3 years ago, not even really in the rotation, bound to get tons and tons of questions and angry tweets from people saying, hey, man, like, how come you're still the same guy you were 3 years ago? You're a lottery pick. We could have had player X instead of you. And so I think that the man bun is actually a pretty creative way to deflect a lot of that, right? I mean, you throw that out there. That's all anybody wants to talk about. And, you know, now you're free to just jack 3 3-pointers and never play defense.
Yeah, the cult of personality. That's what he's trying to create right now. My comment on Myers Leonard, what I enjoy about the man bun is that he's part of a storied history of white NBA big men who spend a few years in the NBA and then just get like really weird with the hair. I think dating back to Cherokee Parks, you can look at Scott Pollard, you can look at Spencer Hawes with a man bun of his own in Charlotte.
Robert Swift,
you know, I would like a gallery of, oh, Adam Morrison. Didn't Adam Morrison have cornrows at some point?
Not sure, but he definitely went off the deep end in different ways.
Yeah, I just think that you could put together like a really solid photo gallery of like 20 white guys who went out there with their hairstyles. And Myers Leonard is now part of the fraternity. And I think that's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's all we have to say. All right. Another question here, though. There are 3 500 teams in the Central right now. Pistons, Pacers, Bucks. Which of that group can push 50 wins? This is from Joke Funberg.
I don't think I see any of those teams pushing 50 wins, but I think if you're going to, you know, play the stock market game on them, you definitely are buying Detroit, because they're just kind of in get by mode right now, right? And then once Reggie's up to speed and really doing his thing, they should be back winning at the kind of percentages that they were last year when he was in the lineup. And so I think from the Pistons standpoint, this hasn't been like a flashy start to the year. Like, this hasn't been something that we hardly have ever even really mentioned. But in terms of like getting the job done and, you know, making it work in kind of an adverse situation and buying yourself time, it's a gigantic win for them. So I think ceiling wise of those three teams, I would definitely say Detroit has the highest ceiling.
I completely agree. Looking at the Pacers, I'm pretty worried about them. I think they're going to have like a lot of sort of fits and starts here over the next few months, because they're good enough to hover around 500, but they are flawed enough to frustrate the hell out of Pacers fans. And then the Bucks, beyond Giannis and Jabari, they just really don't have much on that team. So I think they are going to be like a 35 win team, not a 50 win team. But I'm not ready to give up on the Pistons yet. Two more questions here. Are you enjoying watching Dwight Howard not be corny and contrived on the Hawks? This is from Guacamole Mania.
That one seems like it was directed personally to you, because that seems like the only words that you ever used to describe Dwight Howard.
Actually, you know what? That might... You may not have even been included in that tweet. It might have been directly to me. You're right. I'm sort of, you know, I like Dwight on Atlanta is a real testament to what good big men can do in the East. Like I would send tape of Hawks games to Boogie daily and be like, look, you just got to get to the East. You will turn into a completely different player, be twice as dominant as you are in Sacramento, and extend your career an extra couple years, because Dwight was pretty broken down the past few years with the Rockets, but like put him against Cody Zeller and he suddenly looks like a whole new player. So I can't say that I'm ever truly enjoying Dwight Howard, but the Hawks have been pretty impressive, and they like Tim Hardaway is playing well now. Schroeder is awesome. I don't know. That's a good team.
Yeah, I think you should pat yourself on the back a little bit. I mean, you did say the Hawks were going to Hawks their way to like 55 wins, right? And
yeah, they just always pretty pull much this what shit, man.
Yeah, that's pretty much what they're doing. And the fact that they're able to slide Dwight in, which is a very big stylistic change from, you know, the Horford era, the fact that they're able to just move on from Teague, that says a little bit about Teague, but I think it says a lot about the Hawks structure too. you know, they're in a good spot. I can't say that I'm really enjoying them, though, to be honest.
this is good. We're keeping it honest today. All right, final three, final question. Give me your top three logos and courts in the NBA and your bottom three. So this, the question was phrased, which NBA team's corporate design do you like best and worst? From NBA Kenner.
I tend to favor the classic looks. So I'm kind of Bulls, Sixers. That's kind of the direction that I go in terms of the ones that I like the most. You know, I have a hard time actually dissecting this question because you start to compare it to like the actual experiences going to those buildings. And so, although it's not like the most enjoyable or the prettiest, like a place like San Antonio, where when the jerseys are black, when the crowd is just like completely bloodthirsty, when there's snakes in the locker room, when, you know, sometimes the air conditioning just cuts out in the middle of the NBA finals, drenching LeBron in, cramps. The whole experience is like something that you can really kind of gravitate towards. So I kind of like put the Spurs into that mix. They also have some of the worst alternate jerseys.
Let's just to recap on this podcast, our first mailbag, you created a question to continue your war on Canada. We were asked to create
a, two questions.
We were asked to create a war squad around the league and you created a peace squad. And now you picked the Spurs for the best logo in the league. And I don't know what to do with you at this point.
Okay, slow down. First of all, the actual
Spur... I think this might be our last pod.
Okay, the actual Spur logo itself is pretty cool. I'm talking about overall aesthetics here, corporate design. When you go to that AT&T Center, that's like an experience you will not forget. It sticks with you. That might actually be sticking with you in a bad way. But ask LeBron how much he enjoyed going to San Antonio with those Miami teams. I guarantee you he'll tell you that that was like a house of horrors. So that's why I put them in that category. But I also did say a traditional favorite, the Bulls. I mean, you know, that's pretty obvious. And the Sixers is pretty obvious. There's not a lot to talk about. Oh, cool. Like you didn't screw up these beautiful red, white, and blue jerseys that Allen Iverson made famous. Oh, cool. Like you have the best logo in the middle of the United Center and you've got Jordan's banners hanging in the rafters. Like those are obvious picks.
That's
everybody
fair.
Knows
that's
those.
Fair. My number one is the Blazers. You just can't beat Portland. And last place for me will always be the Nets. They have the ugliest uniforms in the league. They need to figure something out. What seemed cool in 2011 was not cool in 2016. But
I've got some other bad ones.
Go ahead.
Thunder.
Yeah.
Clippers. And Hawks.
They were both on my list. The Hawks belong there also, and the the Clutch City t-shirt jerseys that the Rockets were wearing last night, those need to be burned immediately.
And I do like the Clutch City nickname too. And I like the Clutch blog, the Rockets blog, but yeah, those jerseys weren't quite put together, you know, with maximum thought in terms of how the final product. But I mean, you look at Oklahoma City and LA, I think the Clippers jerseys, I have the same problems with both of them, is that they just don't really grab you. It's kind of blah, you know, and it kind of feels like it was put together very quickly on Photoshop and just kind of like, hey, we tested like 20 of these looks and they're all kind of similarly, you know, uninspiring. So we just went with this one. And yeah, that's why they're on my list.
Well, look, let's not distract the people from... The most important takeaway of this podcast is I'm never going to forgive you for choosing a peace squad.
Make, make me feel guilty for your bloodthirsty death threats about me. Look, like that's somehow my fault. Unbelievable.
Our relationship is in trouble right now. But no, this was a lot of fun. Thank you everyone for the questions. The ones we didn't get to, I have saved, and you can tweet stuff at us. We're going to keep doing these mailbags and, it'll be fun. And next week, we will be back with a holiday episode at some point. But until then, thank you. And any last words, Ben?
No, I just like to thank Marcos and Tommy for the questions. Both really incisive queries from our friends.
Special
above.
Thank you. Special thank you to all our dedicated Raptors fans out there.
Appreciate it.
I'll talk to you soon, man.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.